Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the forthcoming summit between Trump and Putin on Monday in Helsinki, Finland, which has European allies and even Republican senators concerned about the apparent undue influence Putin has over Trump. Former National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia, Angela Stent, the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs, and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University, who is the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, joins us. We will assess the extent to which the Trump-Putin summit might be a combination of mendacity and incompetence, given how the much-ballyhooed summit with Kim Jong-un turned out to be nothing more than a gift to a brutal dictator. And since our president is looking forward to a meeting he expects to be, quote, the easiest of them, after having trashed the two women who are leaders of our most important allies, Germany and the UK, we will look into Trump's bromance with Putin, the leader of a hostile country which meddled in the 2016 election, presidential elections, to help elect Donald J. Trump. Then, with today's unveiling of a new asylum policy by the Trump administration announcing that claims by immigrants fleeing from gang violence and domestic abuse will now be immediately rejected, we will turn to the fate of the thousands of migrants and refugees appealing for asylum. Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the bestseller Enrique's Journey, Sonia Nazario, a board member of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, and contributing editor contributing writer to the New York Times, where she has an article, The End of Asylum, joins us. We will examine the Trump administration's illegal efforts in denying the recent wave of migrants credible fear interviews and well-considered trials, and assess the chances migrants and refugees have of filing successful asylum claims in the future. Then finally, we'll speak with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist and co-founder of the investigative reporting news service DCReport.org, who has written extensively about global banking and tax havens and is the author of Blood Bankers. He joins us to discuss Deutsche Bank's $10 billion fine for money laundering and the role it played in rescuing Trump's business and the possible influence of former Deutsche Bank managing director Justin Kennedy in getting his father, Justice Anthony Kennedy, to retire from the Supreme Court before the November elections. And joining us now is Angela Stent, the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs, and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. From 2004 to 2006, she served as national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State. She's the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Brief. Angela Stent.
Glad to be on.
So what do you expect? There's a lot of disquiet amongst European allies and indeed a number of lawmakers, including Republican senators, about what might transpire on Monday in this meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, Finland, before departing for the NATO summit and the visit to the UK and the summit with Putin. Donald Trump said Putin would be easy compared to the rest of it. Now, one of the things that's happened in the interim has been pretty extraordinary. In Germany, our president basically made life difficult for Angela Merkel, who is in a reasonably precarious political situation, and he referred to the situation in the UK with Theresa May as being in disarray, and he's even called or floated the idea that he wants to meet with Boris Johnson, who just resigned. So let's deal with that. As somebody who's tried to follow international relations, I've never heard of a world leader basically making life difficult for the heads of states amongst allied countries that the United States deal with. Normally, heads of state sort of protect each other. It's kind of something of a club. But in this case, we have a president who seems to be perfectly willing to almost campaign against foreign leaders like the head of Germany and the head of the UK.
Well, this is a completely unprecedented and extraordinary situation. Obviously, world leaders can argue behind closed doors, and there have been some sharp moments in previous NATO meetings and allied meetings. But first of all, to publicly criticize your closest allies, as he did with Chancellor Merkel, saying that she was captive to the Russians on the one hand, and then Germany isn't pulling its weight. It owes the United States $1 trillion, things like that. And as you say, praising Boris Johnson just after he's resigned, and in fact, Trump is on a three-day visit to Great Britain. It's unprecedented, and it could only be really music to Putin's ears, because President Trump has consistently criticized the U.S.'s closest allies and has consistently praised Vladimir Putin. And again, this is an unprecedented situation.
So what do you think is the hold, or whatever this relationship is, the idea that you have this anomaly of our leader trashing our closest and longest-serving allies, at the same time praising at every turn somebody who I think is probably our most aggressive adversary?
Well, the most innocent explanation is that since at least 1987, President Trump has been very keen on building a Trump Tower and doing business deals, real estate deals in Russia. He first went to the Soviet Union in the late Gorbachev era, and ever since then, the Trump Organization has been trying to build a Trump Tower there. So far, hasn't succeeded, but was even trying to negotiate a deal even in 2016 and 2017. So that's one explanation. Secondly, we know that President Trump admires strong men, strong leaders. Leaders who can get things done. Remember what he said about President Kim Jong-un. You know, when he walks into a room, everybody stands up and listens to him. So I think there's something there. There are authoritarian leaders whom he's praised. So that I think would be, and I think the other, in Putin's case, I think because President Trump wants to do everything differently, the opposite of what President Obama did. Despite the reset that worked well when Medvedev was president, Obama and Putin did not have a good relationship, and it deteriorated sharply after Edward Snowden landed in Russia. So I think Trump wants to prove that, unlike Obama, he can make a deal with Putin and relations can get much better. Now, there may be more sinister explanations for this, but obviously we don't know them yet. And as we sit here, we, you know, await the outcome of the Mueller inquiry, which could shed more light on this.
Well, as you mentioned, there might be something more sinister. So leaving aside mendacity, surely one of the fears that analysts have and practitioners of foreign policy have is the example of what happened with Kim Jong-un, which was largely a photo op. And now there's more and more evidence that whatever's agreed to is not the way Kim sees it. Now the Chinese, of course, are relaxing their sanctions. 90% of goods go into and out of North Korea via China. So it's the biggest trading partner, you know, by a factor of, 90%. How much bigger can you get? And here we have lost our leverage over China in terms of cooperating, because we're almost declaring a trade war against China. So couldn't you describe the foreign policy not so much as mendacious, but as incompetent?
Well, so far, clearly, it has focused on, the show business aspects of holding a summit, for instance, with a leader coming out and saying everything's great, or in the case of NATO, showing that he was tough and strong and yet saying something completely different at the end of the summit when he said that, you know, the allies had now stepped up to the plate. They were going to spend much more on defense, and he had a great relationship with Angela Merkel. So I think going into the summit with Putin, what he would like to happen, and in a way the best outcome of that summit could be if the two of them come out and say, okay, we've agreed that we're now going to start talks on Syria, particularly Iran's role in Syria, on Ukraine, resolving the crisis, on arms control, extending, for instance, the New START strategic nuclear arms agreement, maybe some other issues, and, you know, our officials will get together and we'll have these working groups and go forward. That doesn't mean that anything will actually happen, but at least they will come out and give the appearance that they have agreed to move forward and to try and normalize the relationship to something less tense than it is now. that I think would be wouldn't be a bad outcome, even though one would have to see how much of it was implemented. You know, that would be okay. A bad outcome, obviously, would be, you know, if, for instance, President Trump comes out and says, well, Crimea is part of Russia, and, you know, Ukraine's much closer to Russia than it is to us, and I know that Russia didn't interfere in our election process. That would not be good. So I think those are the kinds of things we have to watch for.
And again, I'm speaking with Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Affairs and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. From 2004 to 2006, she served as national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State. She's the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. So in terms of speculation about what hold Putin may have over President Trump, I did speak with a very highly decorated former CIA officer recently who even speculated that this relationship, for the want of a better description, in terms of its significance, could rival Germany putting Lenin into a boxcar and sending him home back to Russia in 1917. Now, obviously, neither of us have any proof, and we'll wait to see what Mueller comes up with. But what seems to be out there in the public record and in open sources is this money laundering that's been going on. Deutsche Bank got fined $10 billion for laundering largely Russian money. And my understanding is that even if you go back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union's assets, its cash, hundreds of millions of dollars, ended up in Manhattan real estate. So has there been a pipeline for some time between the Soviet Union and now Russia and the oligarchs and New York real estate?
Well, there certainly has been since the Soviet collapse. I mean, once the Soviet Union collapsed, as you say, the Communist Party had considerable assets. Some of these assets were in the West, but I think it's been much more concentrated, you know, starting in the 1990s, and, you know, large amounts of Russian money, both in London and also in New York. So it's clear from some of the things that have already emerged from the Mueller inquiry that we know about, that the issue of, if you look at what's happening to Paul Manafort, that the issue of money laundering, of improper financial transactions, particularly in the real estate market, are certainly there. I mean, the question is, in the end, how are to whom these going to be? Are these going to be attributed? But that certainly it appears to be part of the inquiry that's going on now.
Well, there was recently a group of prominent American liberals co-signed a letter. I think it was organized by the editor of The Nation, Katrina VandenHeuvel, and her husband, Stephen Cohen. And a number of people signed it, including a very close friend of mine, Gloria Steinem. And basically what they were saying in this letter is that, you know, and I think Jack Matlock was one of the people as well, saying that basically that this situation with Russia and the United States has gotten out of hand, that it's become politicized, that the Democrats are beating the war drums and the Republicans, of course. I mean, this is what's so strange. The party that used to be the full of red baiters and Rush and Soviet haters is now making excuses for Putin, and a whole delegation of Republican senators just went to Moscow and had a very, very pleasant meeting on July the 4th. So it's a very strange turn of events. I agree that.
Although the senators have actually come back and they've said something different since they come back. Mm-hmm. So they've been very critical of the Russians. So there's a slight disconnect between what was said there. No, but there's been a complete reversal in people's views, because most Democrats obviously blame Russia for the fact that Donald Trump is in the White House. And although there are Republicans that are critical of Russia, I think President Trump's base is, likes Russia. They like Putin. And then, as you say, you, on the other hand, have people like Stephen Cohen and Katrina VandenHeuvel and others who signed that letter who actually agree with Trump's base that, you know, that this has gotten out of hand and that we have to improve ties to Russia. So I think it's true that Russia has become a toxic subject here because of all these inquiries into what happened into 2016. And some of this is exaggerated. I mean, when I go to Russia and I talk to my friends there, they say, we don't understand you Americans. You're making us 10 feet tall, you know, as if we can manipulate the American political system and damage your democracy. So clearly some of it is exaggerated here and hyped up. But nevertheless, you know, we do know that Russia did interfere in the election. And, you know, Russia has launched this war in southeastern Ukraine, in which over 10,000 people have died, and that it, you know, there's information war going on. It supports different separatist groups. So I think, you know, it's appropriate to take a very hard-nosed look towards Russia, but there should be some engagement. There have to be more channels of communication open. And so, as I say, that would be the best outcome of this Trump visit.
Well, the letter also goes back to the nuclear standoff, with the U.S. and Russia having enormous numbers of nuclear weapons pointed at each other. I don't know whether the U.S. targets Russia around the clock, but my understanding is that Russia does target the U.S. And that, of course, was always brought out during the Cold War, that we have to stop this madness. But during the Cold War, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the Politburo controlled nuclear weapons. My concern about Russia today is, first of all, in geopolitics, I don't think we've ever had the phenomenon of the combination of national security and organized crime, that nuclear weapons and the mafia. And on top of that, it seems like Russia today is a KGB state, as opposed to having the Politburo and the Communist Party have supremacy. So I'm concerned about command and control of Russian nuclear weapons, but at the same time, deterrence seems to work. It has worked. We survived the decades-long nuclear Cold War with Russia. So how much is the idea of bringing up the danger of nuclear war something that has some real traction, or should we be focusing on the fact that this is a new situation vis-a-vis the custody of nuclear weapons with essentially a gangster state having nuclear weapons?
Well, first of all, I think we have to sort of differentiate a few things. Yes, Russia is certainly, unlike the Soviet Union, it's a highly personalized, informal system. It's run by a very, very small group of people. And unlike in the Soviet Union, where you did have a Politburo, you had a central committee, you had more regularized institutions of decision-making. And in Russia, there are very few formal institutions that really do much, and it's all informal. One has to be concerned about that. But, you know, so far, the control of the nuclear weapons are under control of, you know, the people who run the state there. I think one does have to be concerned about the potential absence of any arms limitation agreements if this New START treaty, negotiated, of course, by President Obama and then President Medvedev, if that is not renewed, and that is something that Trump and Putin could do together by executive order on Monday. They could say that they're going to renew it for another 5 years. It expires in 2021. If there is no such agreement, and if that falls by the wayside, then it'll be the first time since 1972, since Richard Nixon went to Moscow, that we don't have a U.S.-Russian agreement limiting strategic nuclear weapons. And then that really does promote proliferation. I mean, both Russia and the U.S. now, both the Trump administration and Putin have said that they're going to modernize their nuclear weapons, that they're going to pour more money into it. And then the example for other countries thinking of acquiring nuclear weapons would be very negative if the U.S. and Russia couldn't come to an agreement on that. So I would be quite concerned about that agreement. And then there's one more agreement, which is on intermediate range nuclear forces, which Gorbachev and Reagan signed in 1987. And now both sides have accused each other of cheating on it. That's something else that we do need to talk about. Otherwise, you can get a proliferation of these shorter-range nuclear weapons. So I think that's a concern. I think it's more of a concern than the idea that the nuclear arsenal is not under the control of the state in Russia.
Well, I guess the point I would try to make is that I don't see the logic of that we should forgive Putin for what he does and what he's doing, particularly in attacking our elections, because he has nuclear weapons. And a lot of liberals, for example, castigate our new national security advisor, John Bolton, as being such a hawk. Well, he's nothing compared to Nikolai Patrushev. I mean, the national security advisor in Russia is really a dangerous guy.
Well, I mean, it's actually true that John Bolton has not been a fan, for instance, of traditional arms control treaties. So we'll see. But you're right. Everything is relative.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us. I hope we get a chance to talk again, Angela Stent.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Angela Stent, the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs, and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. From 2004 to 2006, she served as national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State. And she's the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. And we can take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the consequences of the Trump administration's announcement today that they're ending asylum for immigrants fleeing violence.
To send someone away, I've got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count its ups. They lead you to the race where no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sonia Nazario, who's a board member of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, and a contributing opinion writer to The New York Times, who spent more than 20 years reporting and writing about social issues, most recently as a project reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her six-part investigative series, Enrique's Journey, which is now a best-selling book, and she has an article at The New York Times, The End of Asylum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sonia Nazario.
Thank you, Ian.
And the Trump administration's announcements today that they're ending asylum and they will no longer consider fleeing from gang violence or domestic abuse in any way a mitigating factor, and they're doing away with credible fear interviews and well-considered trials. So I guess this follows a recent announcement by the Attorney General, and it's so let's start with that. This seems to have been in the works for a while.
Yeah, I think since the administration started, there's been a whole-scale attack on asylum. And I think what struck me is that reporting about immigration for so long, when you talk to people who oppose immigration, their rallying cry is rule of law. But in many ways, our government is violating our own laws in the ways that it is trying to restrict asylum. We have signed international treaties, and we have incorporated those treaties into our immigration law, that if you present yourself at our border, and when I speak about the immigration issue across the country, what I try to instill in people is that there are people who come as economic migrants and cross into the United States without permission, and then there are people who come here fleeing violence as asylees, or if they are brought from other countries as refugees. And an asylee is legally entitled to present themselves at our border and ask for safety, ask for asylum. That is a legal process, and that's what many of these folks in Central America are doing. And as I concluded in this opinion piece today in the New York Times, the Trump administration is demanding that immigrants follow the law, Americans should demand the same thing of our government, because in so many ways we are violating our own laws when it comes to asylum.
Well, it seems that there's an element of cruelty in all of this, and it's supposedly a strategy, I guess, to make to make life difficult for immigrants and to treat them so badly. And you can't do anything worse than ripping children from the arms of their parents. And the previous Flores agreement, I spoke recently with the former head of the INS at the time who signed that Flores agreement, it seemed to be a perfectly workable situation where immigrants come in to the country, and rather than imprison them, they put an ankle monitor, and the whole purpose is for them to show up at a court hearing, which they're guaranteed. And I guess it was derided as catch and release, but many of these people went into, rather than go into some makeshift prison that's making some contractor rich, they were, housed with relatives, etc. And they, I think by a huge majority, showed up at their hearings. So that was the system.
And it cost a few percentage points of what it would cost to lock up a mother with two children, cost more than $900. If you do the most expensive version of releasing people, which is with a case manager, a lot of people are simply confused by the bureaucracy and when they're supposed to show up to court. It's not very crystal clear to a lot of people. But if you hook them up with a case manager that helps them in a variety of ways, but also explains to them, this is the process and this is what your obligations are and this is what you must do, 99% of them do show up to court. And it's, as a taxpayer, to me, it's way cheaper, more humane, more efficient than throwing them in these prisons like the one I went to last week in Adelanto, California, where, 5 years ago, 9 in 10 people were released in this in some way. Now 9 in 10 of them are held indefinitely until their cases end, which can take months or can take years. And at Adelanto, people, basically they're trying to push you to your breaking point so you will give up on your legal rights. Adelanto had 3 people die in 3 months last year. The medical care is not stellar. People talked about maggots and mold in the food. They're paid $1 a day to work all day cleaning or cooking. There were suicide attempts last year. Women trying to hang themselves or kill themselves with nail cutters. These places are intentionally, many people believe, put in extremely isolated places, like in the middle of the Mojave Desert, so that it's very difficult to get a lawyer who can bear the cost of driving 5 hours round trip to go see you and go to every single one of your hearings. So most of these people in Adelanto have no lawyer, and if you have no lawyer, 9 in 10 of them lose their cases. But if you have a lawyer, nearly half of these migrants do win their cases. So it's much more humane and efficient to do it in this way. What I argue with in terms of liberals is that once you have lost your case, I say be open-hearted on the front end, allow people to have their day in court. But if they then do lose their case, then we have to stick to rule of law in that case as well. And instead of putting money into the prisons, put it into ICE going out and then arresting that person and deporting them. I don't have a problem with that. I think you have to be consistent if you're saying we need to live by the rule of law.
And again, I'm speaking with Sonia Nazario, who's a board member of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, and a contributing opinion writer to The New York Times, who spent more than 20 years reporting and writing about social issues, most recently as a project reporter for The Los Angeles Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her 6-part investigative series, Enrique's Journey, which is now a best-selling book, and she has an article at The New York Times, The End of Asylum. But you have to add to this kind of arbitrary cruelty on the part of the Trump administration, and frankly, people who are prepared to rip children from the arms of their parents and didn't think there was anything wrong with that are deeply suspect, if not beyond the pale. But apparently one of Trump's motives here, and this is what he's sort of telling the rank and file, that a bunch of terrorists from the Middle East infiltrating, pretending to be parents of Latino children, And therefore, they have to do this DNA of everybody. And that's, of course, again, that's expensive. I think most kids know who their parents are, and most parents know who their kids are, don't they?
I'm trying to keep a straight face. We've never known of a terrorist crossing across our southern border. We do know of some who have crossed our northern border. I've always argued that the Zetas or the cartels are very good at kind of weeding out anyone who would cross into the United States and bring an enormous amount of heat on the southern border if that were to happen. So far, it simply hasn't happened. Most of these people are fleeing violence in Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, which are among the most violent countries in the world. And we established our asylum laws following the Second World War. We had a moral reckoning. We had turned away a ship with 900 Jews not allowed them to dock in Miami and turned them back, and 250 of those Jews were murdered in the Holocaust. We ignored a proposal to let 20,000 Jewish children come here during the war. And we vowed after the war, we were a leader of the United States in saying, never again. We will never do this again. We will stand up and help people who are running from harm. And we will ask other countries to do the same thing. And now we are, it's very convenient to stick by those rules and those laws when there's not a lot of asylees. And yes, there has been an increase in people running from harm. And I believe we have an obligation to stick by them. We're not talking about a flood of people. We had, in the first 9 months of this fiscal year, 68,000 families apprehended at our southern border and 37,000 unaccompanied immigrant children. That's one football stadium that I see at many colleges I speak at. I believe that our country can have that amount of compassion. I believe that we should not be illegally turning people away from our ports of entry and saying, I mean, the Border Patrol agents are saying to people, come back, there's no more asylum, the United States is full. That's illegal. It's illegal to penalize asylum seekers per our laws. And we're criminally prosecuting these folks and throwing them in horrible prisons and snatching away their children. And a federal court last week ruled that you cannot indefinitely lock these folks up, and yet we're still doing it with tens of thousands of people. We are violating our own laws. And my question was, is the American people willing to do that, to break our own laws in order to try and, quote, seal our border, which is impossible?
So is this a solution in search of a problem? In other words, the only rationale and the only excuse for what the Trump administration is doing is if you're trying to deter some uncontrollable flood of people coming across the border. And frankly, Jay Johnson, the former head of Homeland Security, recently said in an interview, no matter how tough Trump and Sessions and all of these red-blooded men...
We tried it. It didn't work.
Well, but no matter how tough they get, one, it doesn't work, and two, it will never work until you address the social conditions in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
Absolutely, and also address our drug issues in this country, the demand for drugs, and instead of our war on drugs, which has been an abject failure and that each family has paid $10,000 towards and has simply not worked. We need more drug treatment and prevention, and God forbid, what we're doing hasn't worked. Maybe we should try what Portugal has done, legalize small quantities of everything. It's a mess for 5 years, crime goes up, but now 15 years later, they've cut drug use in half. But yes, I wrote a piece in the New York Times 2 years ago. I went to the most violent neighborhood in the murder capital of the world for 4 years in a row in San Pedro Sula, Honduras. And there the U.S. had implemented these violence prevention programs, implementing what we know has worked and we developed in Los Angeles and in Boston. And in that neighborhood, the worst of the worst, in 2 years, homicides went down 62%, and it cut the number of kids fleeing in half. That was from a neighborhood where people, the gangsters that controlled the neighborhood brazenly, played soccer with the head of someone they had just decapitated, to a place where kids could actually play in broad daylight out in the middle of the street. instead of supporting those programs, this administration has cut them by 15 to 20%. We need to do more of that. That costs $100 million a year in Honduras to implement those pilot programs versus billions that you have to spend once these children and these families arrive at our border. You have to pay to apprehend them. You have to pay to move them. You have to pay to put them in prisons. You have to pay for the court costs. You have to pay to move them all around to all of these places. It's way cheaper to try to deal with this. And we know how to reduce violence in these places. We've done it in Los Angeles and in Boston and other places, and we're trying the same techniques there. We should do more of that.
Well, just in closing, what can our audience, who are probably furious listening to this, what can they do?
Well, I think they should call their representatives and write their representatives and say that they disagree with the policies that we are implementing in terms of asylum, that they believe that people should continue to allow to present at our border and ask for safety from our government and have a process that they can go through, starting with a credible fear interview at the border that determines whether you have a significant fear of returning to your country. That opens the door for you to be able to see a judge, an immigration judge, and go through the whole process of asylum. I think we need to demand that of our representatives. And I think, you know, we shouldn't just be out in the streets demanding that parents be reunified with the children. This is a much bigger issue of our efforts to completely gut our asylum system that will affect many more people. And it sounds, I think you need to understand that when you deny asylum to someone or you prevent someone from accessing their legal right to asylum, in many cases, you're sending people back to danger and even their deaths. We know of at least 90 cases of people sent back by the United States and Mexico in recent years that have been documented who have died shortly after being sent back. Consequences are catastrophic. So
Sonia, we need to fight
for asylum.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate your time, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sonia Nazario, who's a board member of KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, and a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times, who spent more than 20 years reporting and writing about social issues, most recently as a project reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her six-part investigative series, Enrique's Journey, which is now a best-selling book, and she has an article at the New York Times, The End of Asylum. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the Trump family's ties to Deutsche Bank.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. I went a-walking.
That's my money man down on his knees. He ain't praying, but he damn sure ought to be. He's in a place where money doesn't grow on trees. Oh, it's a prison, but it's doing more than shoot the breeze. How does it feel, no money man?
Not too good.
What did you do with my money?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development, the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's a co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, James. And there's been some reports about some kind of dealings, subterfuge involved in secret negotiations between Donald Trump and outgoing Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, and that Kennedy's son, Justin, who was a banker with, or maybe still is, with Deutsche Bank, who dealt with the Trump Organization, who's close to Donald Trump Jr., may have played a role in getting his father to retire earlier, and that some of the reporting from NBC News, it's been walked back a bit, suggested that the Trump administration had enticed Kennedy by saying, we'll guarantee you that you will put on your clerk, your former clerk, Brett Kavanaugh, to replace you. So none of that's been proven. But I'm turning to you today to get some clarity, since you know about Deutsche Bank, who, by the way, were fined $10 billion for laundering mostly Russian money. So what do you know about this connection?
Well, I think that this is an example of one step, one bridge too far in terms of theories about the current administration. You know, Deutsche Bank is Donald Trump's main big bank creditor at a time when other banks, all other U.S. banks and global banks, you know, had refused to lend to him after 2000 because of his, depending on how you count, 4 to 6 bankruptcies in the 1990s. Deutsche Bank was strikingly the one bank globally that was willing to lend. However, the problem with this theory is, first of all, Justin Kennedy actually left Deutsche Bank in 2009, which is before the latest money laundering case that you mentioned was involved. They prosecuted for behavior that went on from 2010 to 2014. There was an earlier instance of Deutsche Bank money laundering back in the 1990s, so they're definitely a bank that's known for being close to Russian money and to having dodgy relationships. I think the most interesting people around Deutsche Bank that were lending to Trump were mainly, many of them were in the private wealth group, the private banking side of the arm, and Justin Kennedy was working for the real estate arm. So it's a little bit hard from the outside to really make sense of all this, but, you know, it just, you know, there are plenty of other players at Deutsche Bank that really do need to be looked at closely, but I don't think Justin Kennedy is necessarily at the top of that list. There's a guy named Joseph Ackerman, for example, who's chairman of the Bank of Cyprus and, you know, was chairman of Deutsche Bank from 2004 to 2012, and right during this period when most of these loans to Trump were put on, he had extensive relationship with Putin, with Russia, and, you know, Wilbur Ross became vice chairman of the Bank of Cyprus in 2013. So, you know, Ackerman's a figure here that we should be looking at. There's also the loans that have been made to Jared Kushner in New York by Deutsche Bank and to his real estate partners. You know, that's pretty interesting. And I'm sure Mueller is taking a look at all these relationships. But for my money, the Kennedy theory is just a bridge too far. We have many other reasons why Kennedy was willing to step down at this point. He was 81, ready to retire at that age. And, you know, he's never been a liberal. He's been more of a centrist. But I think he was satisfied that Trump was going to nominate one of his, you know, his own favorite law clerks, which is Brett Kavanaugh. And Kavanaugh turns out a Yale graduate, Yale Law School, you know, quite a strict constructionist. It looks like he would be willing to give Trump the benefit of the doubt with respect to things like whether he can issue presidential pardons without being accused of obstruction of justice, or the extent to which he could, you know, do things like fire Mueller. There's a lot of reasons to be concerned about this appointment, but I think the relationship with Judge Kennedy was much more direct for Kavanaugh than it was Deutsche Bank.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development, the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. So it does look like, I don't know what role that Deutsche Bank played in rescuing some of Jared Kushner's bad real estate investments, the biggest and most draining of them all. The giant albatross over the Kushner family's company has been 666 Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. They tried to shake down the Chinese. They tried to shake down the Qatari government for money. Yeah. But it looks like they've succeeded in getting $700 million from Brookfield Asset Management. And they have ties to the Qatar government. But they also are trying to purchase Westinghouse Electric, the nuclear power wing of Westinghouse. So what's going on there? Because Kushner is high up in this government. So that on the surface is pretty suspicious when you give a big loan to a company who's one of the major partners in the company is also a senior White House advisor. So what do you know about that?
Well, this is an interesting set of financial problems that Kushner has developed here over time. And it may be that Justin Kennedy, after he left Deutsche Bank, was actually involved in lending to the 666 Fifth Avenue purchase. You know, we need to know more about the loan book there, but than we do. But I think right now the appropriate focus of Mueller on Kushner is with respect to some of the money laundering that's been going on in New York. We have this interesting case involving Rudy Giuliani's law firm setting up accounts in the Netherlands in 2007 that were used by Felix Sater and his Kazakhstan partners, the Krapanovs, to basically move money through Cyprus into the Trump Soho. And, you know, this is a case that the Netherlands, Dutch authorities are actually looking at with respect to whether Giuliani and his law firm were involved in outright money laundering. Some of that money may have ended up in the Kushner real estate deals as well. So, you know, there's stuff that's much, I think, closer to the, you know, to being of prosecutorial interest here involving, you know, real substantiated transactions where you have predicate offenses being stealing assets from a developing country like Kazakhstan, laundering through Dutch companies and then sending them into real estate in New York, including the Trump Soho. You know, that's sounds to me like all the elements of a you know, sort of prosecution are ready for some authority to take a look at. So you know, there's a number of things with regard to Giuliani's background and his relationships with people like Pavel Fuchs, who's a Ukrainian mobster, and you know, we have a picture of Giuliani standing next to Pavel Fuchs in June of 2017, you know, shaking hands and smiling. We just have no account for why this fellow who's been implicated in laundering money for the Yanukovych and the Ukraine, you know, and was barred from entering the U.S. in December of last year, you know, has this bosom buddy relationship with Giuliani. So, you know, these are the questions that I'd like to see answered right now. I'm less concerned about the, you know, the Kavanaugh appointment explanation than some of the conspiracy theorists on the web are.
Well, what about you mentioned a possible relationship between Justin Kennedy, the son of the outgoing Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, and Kushner? Now, last month, Kushner reported in a federal ethics filing that he owns hundreds of companies and holds as much as $811 million in assets, which generates as much as $222 million of income for him last year. That has to be the highest income any White House aide has ever received in one year, right? $222 million?
I think this is a really legitimate issue for, you know, the American people to be concerned about. We have people with all kinds of potential conflicts of interest within a hair's breadth of the presidency and, you know, willing, it's really hard at that level to separate out your own private interests from, you know, in many cases, we've expected senior officials to put their assets and their business interests in trust and to have them at arm's length. But that has not been done with many members of this administration, starting with the president himself. You know, they have not maintained a truly arm's length relationship from their business interests. And I think the fact that there are so many, you know, seriously indebted businessmen, you know, people from Kushner and the president to Wilbur Ross, you know, right on down to Kavanaugh, who it turns out only has a net worth of about that he was a financial assets on the order of less than $50,000. I mean, the guy was borrowing money to buy lots of baseball tickets to, you know, to over the last few years. He may have a lot of real estate assets, which he hasn't had to disclose yet, but, you know, this is on the assets that he has disclosed, Judge Kavanaugh will be one of the least wealthy Supreme Court of appointments ever made. Maybe that's a good thing. I mean, maybe he is. It just indicates that we need to know a lot more about his financial situation. The fact there are so many open questions about this, you know, this whole portfolio of characters and their financial interests indicates that we have, you know, the next year is going to be pretty interesting in terms of what Mueller is able to come up with. And I think, unfortunately, the Congress to date has really not waded deeply into these questions far enough. They've focused on collusion and the, you know, the allegations about the last election, but actually understanding the economics of the kind of chicanery that's gone on in this administration is, I think, from my, you know, from my perspective, following the money has always been the best way into this story.
Well, the Congress today has been grilling the FBI agent, Peter Strzok, and their hearings are all about Hillary Clinton. I mean, they haven't gotten over Hillary Clinton, and they're basically trying to make the Mueller inquiry entirely partisan, and trying to manufacture that and trying to put this guy, bullying him into some kind of admission that the whole thing is partisan. He actually stood his ground pretty well against these outrageous.
I listened to his testimony, and I was impressed with his insistence that in 27 years of government service, he had never, on any occasion, allowed his own personal opinions, you know, to conflict with his professional duties. And I think, you know, and he was quite clear that he'd also been quite critical of Hillary and of Bernie Sanders and of both parties at various points in his private commentary. I mean, I know FBI agents who, you know, are at the other end of the spectrum in terms of political bias and would give you, you know, sort of a whole earful every time you talked about Hillary's emails. But, you know, at the end of the day here, we need an institution like the FBI to be able to separate its political responsibilities, its professional duties from political opinions, which every government official is entitled to their own private views of things. And it's almost impossible to imagine some kind of, you know, sort of a litmus test for keeping people out of office. You'd end up with people who are brainless. But, you know, there's no evidence that Strzok, in any of his behavior, actually managed to bias the investigation one way or the other, no matter how strongly he was concerned about Trump. We know as well that Mueller moved pretty quickly to take care of him. You know, when he found out about these expressions of interest, and Mueller himself is a lifelong Republican. So I don't know what the Republicans are scratching at. It seems to be they're looking for diversion.
Well, that's the whole point, that they're not. This is the only stuff they're investigating, Hillary Clinton's emails. I mean, then that's the obsession on Fox News. It's just surreal. But clearly there's a motive here to, one, prepare the Fox people and the Trump supporters who already believe that's a witch hunt, and to get as many Americans to believing that this whole Mueller inquiry is completely partisan. And on top of that, they're looking for a way for these same Tea Party people who are attacking Peter Strzok today, the FBI agent. They're also recently went after Rod Rosenstein, and they're trying to make impossible demands on him so that they can impeach him. And then
that's right. I mean, the concern that we have now with this, especially with this new appointment to the Supreme Court, is that Mueller is that Trump is kind of trying to lay the foundations for a firing of Mueller, and or at least of Rosenstein. And then I think, you know, this is with a packed Supreme Court. I mean, you really have to go all the way back to FDR's attempt to pack the Supreme Court. You know, what we're facing here is a sort of veto. I mean, basically a court that would permit the president to essentially have his way with the Mueller investigation. And that's the main concern. I'm concerned about many of the ramifications of this particular appointment. But I think one we should all be worried about is the implications for the Mueller investigation.
So just in the last couple of minutes, returning to Deutsche Bank and the fact that they had to pay a $10 billion fine for laundering mostly Russian money, and that this character that ran the bank that loaned a lot of money, $1 billion, I think, to Donald Trump, ended up running a bank in Cyprus that Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, is what, vice president of or partner in? And what's going on in investigating Deutsche Bank? I mean,
well, we're told that there are, you know, there's a, Mueller knows a lot about Deutsche Bank and has gotten access to inside the bank, you know, to information. German authorities, I think, are, you know, obviously concerned that their largest financial institution, you know, has this sort of deep involvement with the U.S. president. Loans outstanding from Deutsche Bank to Donald Trump now have been reduced to about $130 million. When he took office, they were about $330 million. So it wasn't a huge sum of money, but it was more than half of his debts outstanding. And over the years, I think that we can infer that Deutsche Bank also had a significant private banking relationship with President Trump, including probably offshore assets. And, you know, there's some reporting going on that has suggested that, you know, the president was able to exploit the Deutsche Bank relationship and the connections that it supplied, you know, to engage in some of his financial transactions with respect to, you know, attracting Russian money into the U.S. and financing some of the developments that he financed here. He could not have financed without capital flight from the former Soviet Union. So there's a lot more we really we're looking for in terms of, you know, having really needing subpoena power to get into the bank's records here. But, you know, I have no doubt that one motive for the Republicans, you know, sort of being all over this FBI investigation is that they're very worried. The next 6 months, Mueller is going to, you know, he has the Manafort trial coming up. He has the investigation of Kushner is coming to a head. And we also have Michael Cohen. So there's a lot of bad news coming for the Trump administration. I think that's what, you know, one of the reasons we're seeing this this come to terms. But I have no doubt that the Deutsche Bank story will be an important part of what Mueller comes up with.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who's written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he is the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larriva-Latt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.